Journey to the Center of the Earth by Jules Verne. On the 24th of May, 1863, a Sunday, my uncle, Professor Lidenbrock, came rushing back towards his little house at number 19 Königstrasse, one of the oldest streets in the historic part of Hamburg. Martha the maid must have thought she was running very late, for dinner had hardly begun to simmer on the kitchen range. I said to myself, if my uncle is hungry, he'll shout out his annoyance, for he is the most impatient of men. "Professor Lidenbrock here already?" Martha exclaimed in amazement, slightly opening the dining-room door. "Yes, indeed. But dinner has every right not to be cooked, for it's not 2 o'clock yet. It's only just struck the half-hour on St. Michael's." "Then why has Professor Lidenbrock come back?" "Presumably he will tell us." "Oh, here he is. I'm off, Master Axel. You will make him see reason, won't you?" And the good Martha disappeared back into her culinary laboratory. I remained alone. But to make the worst-tempered of professors see reason did not seem possible, given my slightly indecisive character. So I was getting ready for a prudent retreat to my little bedroom at the top of the house, when the front door groaned on its hinges. Large feet made the wooden staircase creak, and the master of the house came through the dining room and burst into his study. On his hurried way through, though, he had thrown his nutcracker head cane in the corner, his broad hat brushed up the wrong way on the table, and the ringing words to his nephew, "Axel, I'm here." Otto Lidenbrock was not a bad man, I will gladly concede. But unless changes happen to him, which is highly unlikely, he will die a terrible eccentric. He was a professor at the Johanneum and gave a course on mineralogy, during which he normally got angry at least once or twice. Not that he was worried whether his students were assiduous at his lectures or whether they paid attention, or whether they were successful later. He hardly bothered about these details. He lectured subjectively, to use the expression from German philosophy, for himself and not for others. He was a learned egoist and a selfish scholar, a well of science whose handle groaned whenever someone wanted to draw something out of it. In a word, a miser. In Germany, there are one or two professors like this. But despite all this, my uncle was an authentic scholar. I cannot emphasize this too much. Although he sometimes broke his samples by handling them too roughly, he combined the geologist's talent with a mineralogist's eye. With his mallet, his steel spike, his magnetic needle, his blow lamp, and his flask of nitric acid, he was highly gifted. From the fracture, appearance, resistance, melting point, sound, smell, and taste of any given mineral, he could put it without hesitation into any one of the 600 classifications recognized by modern science. Such was the character calling for me so impatiently. Imagine a tall, thin man with an iron constitution and youthful blonde hair that made him look a good 10 years younger than his 50. His big eyes darted incessantly around behind imposing glasses. His nose, long and thin, was like a sharpened blade. Unkind people even claimed it was magnetized and picked up iron filings. Absolute slander. It only picked up snuff, but in rather large quantities, to tell the truth. If I add that my uncle took mathematical strides of exactly 3 feet, and that while walking he firmly clenched his fists, the sign of an impetuous temperament, then you will know him well enough not to wish to spend too much time in his company. My uncle was not poor, not for a German professor. The house was entirely his, both building and contents. The latter consisted of his goddaughter, Gräuben, a 17-year-old girl from Vierland, and Martha and myself. In my dual capacity as nephew and orphan, I had become the laboratory assistant for his experiments. With such an eccentric, the only thing to do was to obey. I accordingly hurried into his study. My uncle was buried in his large armchair covered with Utrecht velvet, holding a tome in both hands and studying it with the deepest admiration. "What a book! What a book!" he kept saying. "And what's the title of this marvellous volume?" I asked with too eager an enthusiasm to be genuine. "This work," replied my uncle, getting excited, "is the Heimskringla of Snorri Tulson, the famous 12th century Icelandic author. It is the chronicle of the Norwegian princes who ruled over Iceland."
"Really?" I exclaimed as well as I could. "It's presumably a German translation."
"What?"
the professor replied animatedly.
"A translation? What would I be doing with a translation? Who's bothered about your translation? This is the original work in Icelandic, that magnificent language, both simple and rich, containing the most diverse grammatical combinations, as well as numerous variations in the words."
Like German, I slipped in fortuitously.
"Yes," replied my uncle, shrugging his shoulders. "Not to mention that Icelandic has three genders, like Greek, and declensions of proper nouns, like Latin."
"Ah," I said, my indifference a little shaken. "And are the characters in this book handsome?"
"Characters? Who's speaking of characters, benighted Axel? You did say characters, did you not? Oh, so you are taking this for a printed book. Ignoramus, this is a manuscript, and a runic manuscript at that."
"Runic?"
"Yes. Are you now going to ask me to explain this word as well?"
"There is certainly no need," I replied in the tone of a man wounded in his pride. But my uncle continued all the more, and told me things, despite my opposition, that I wasn't specially interested in knowing.
"Runes," he said, "were handwritten characters formerly used in Iceland, and, according to the tradition, were invented by Odin himself. But look, irreverent boy, admire these forms which sprang from a god's imagination."
I swear that, having no other reply to give, I was going to prostrate myself, the sort of response that necessarily pleases gods and kings, because it has the advantage of never embarrassing them, when an incident happened to set the course of the conversation off on a different path. This was the appearance of a filthy parchment which slid out of a book and fell to earth. My uncle rushed to pick up this scrap with an eagerness easy to understand. An old document locked up in an old book since time immemorial could not fail to have a considerable value in his eyes.
"But what is this?" he exclaimed.
At the same time, he carefully spread the parchment out on his desk. It was 5 inches long and 3 inches wide, with horizontal lines of mumbo-jumbo-style characters written on it.
"It's quite obviously a runic," said the professor, knitting his brows. "This is what we call a cipher, in which the meaning is hidden in letters which have deliberately been mixed up, and which, if properly laid out, would form an intelligible sentence."
For my part, I thought there was absolutely nothing here, but kept my opinions carefully to myself. The professor then took the book and the parchment and compared them with each other.
"The two documents are not in the same hand. The cipher is posterior to the book, for I can see an immediate and irrefutable proof. The first letter is a double M. That would be sought in vain in Tullison's book, for it was added to the Icelandic alphabet only in the 14th century, so therefore at least 200 years elapsed between the manuscript and the document."
That, I must admit, seemed quite logical.
"I am therefore led to think," said my uncle, "that one of the owners of the book must have written out the mysterious characters. But who the devil was this owner? Might he not have inserted his name at some point in the manuscript?"
My uncle lifted his glasses up, took a strong magnifying glass, and carefully worked his way over the first few pages of the book. On the back of the second one, the half-title page, he discovered a sort of stain, which to the naked eye looked like an inkblot. However, looking closer, it was possible to distinguish a few half-erased characters. My uncle realized that this was the interesting part, so he concentrated on the blemish, and with the help of his big magnifying glass, he ended up distinguishing the following symbols, runic characters, which he spelled out without hesitation.
"Arne Saknussem,"
he cried in a triumphant voice.
"But that is a name to conjure with, and an Icelandic one at that. The name of a scholar of the 16th century, a celebrated alchemist."
I looked at my uncle with a certain admiration. "Perhaps it is," I dared reply. "But what would be the point of a scholar hiding a marvellous discovery in such a way?"
"Why? Why? How should I know? Galileo, did he not act in this way for Saturn? In any case, we shall soon see. I shall have the secret of this document, and will neither eat nor sleep until I have discovered it." this Saknussemm was an educated man. It seems certain to me that the original sentence must have been written normally, then jumbled up following a rule which we have yet to discover. The person who got access to the key of the cipher would be able to read it fluently. But what is this key?
Axel, do you have the key?
To this question I replied nothing, and for a good reason. I was gazing at a charming portrait on the wall, one of Greuben. My uncle's ward was then in Altona, staying at one of her relatives. Her absence made me very sad, because I can admit it now. The pretty little Verland girl and the professor's nephew loved each other, with all Germanic patience and calm. We had got engaged without my uncle knowing. He was too much of a geologist to understand such feelings. Greuben was a charming girl, blonde with blue eyes, of a slightly serious character, but she did not love me any the less for all that. For my part, I adored her, if, that is, the word exists in the Teutonic language. As a result of this, the picture of my little Verland girl immediately switched me from the world of reality to that of daydreams, that of memories. It was at this point in my daydream when my uncle, hitting the table with his fist, brought me violently back to reality.
"Let's see," he said. "In order to mix up the letters of a sentence, it seems to me that the first idea to come into one's mind ought to be to write the words vertically instead of horizontally."
Just before performing his critical experiment, Professor Lidenbrock's eyes were throwing sparks out through his glasses. His hands trembled as he picked the old parchment up again. He was profoundly excited. Finally, he coughed loudly, and in a solemn voice, calling out successively the first letter of each word, then the second, he read out a series of letters that were to my ears utterly meaningless. Suddenly, a violent blow from his fist shook the table. Ink spurted. The pen jumped from my hands.
"That's not it,"
shouted my uncle. "It makes no sense."
Then, crossing the study like a cannonball and going down the stairs like an avalanche, he threw himself into the Königstrasse and shot off at a rate of knots. Alone again, I thought of going to tell Greuben everything. But how could I get out of the house? The professor might come back at any moment. What if he summoned me? Or if he wanted to start work again on that word puzzle which even old Oedipus couldn't have solved? And if I wasn't there when he called for me, what might happen then? Would he come back triumphant or discouraged? Who would win, him or the secret? I was wondering about such matters, and without thinking, picked up the parchment with its incomprehensible series of letters, 132 in total. I tried to group the letters into words. I couldn't. Whether you put them into twos, threes, fives, sixes, nothing came out that made sense. The 14th, 15th, and 16th letters did produce the English word ice. The 84th, 85th, and 86th ones gave sir. In the middle of the document, in the third line, I spotted the Latin words rota, mutabile, ira, nec, and atra. It's amazing. These last few words seem to confirm my uncle's view about the language of the document. I can even see luco, which means sacred wood. It's true that the third line also includes tabiled. That sounds completely Hebrew to me. And the last one, mer, arc, and mer, pure and unadulterated French. It was enough to drive you out of your mind. Four different languages in the same preposterous sentence. What possible connection could there be between ice, sir, anger, cruel, sacred wood, changeable, mother, bow, and sea? Only the first and last were easily linked. In a document written in Iceland, it was hardly surprising that there should be a sea of ice. But putting the rest of the puzzle back together was another matter entirely. I was struggling with an insoluble problem. My brain started overheating, my eyes blinking at the sheet. The 132 letters seemed to dance around me, like those silver drops which float above your head when there is a sudden rush of blood to it. I was having a sort of hallucination. I was suffocating. I needed some fresh air. Absent-mindedly, I fanned myself with the piece of paper, with the back and the front passing alternately before my eyes. Imagine my surprise when I thought I caught sight of perfectly intelligible words during a quick turn of the sheet, just as the other side came into view. Latin words, like criterium and terrestri. Suddenly my mind sparked. Through the fleeting glimpses, I had caught sight of the truth. I had discovered how the code worked. Well, you can imagine how excited I felt. My eyes went out of focus and I couldn't see anything. I spread the piece of paper out on the table. All I had to do now to possess the secret was to glance at it. I bent over the table. I placed my finger on each successive letter and, without stopping, without slowing down at all, read the whole message out loud. What amazement. What terror entered my soul. At first, it was like being hit by a blow you didn't expect. What? Had the things I had just discovered really happened? A man had been daring enough to penetrate... No, I cried indignantly. No, I'm not going to tell my uncle. It would be terrible if he got to know about such a journey. He'd just want to have a go himself. Nothing would stop a geologist of such determination. He would leave anyway, against all obstacles, whatever the cost. And he'd take me with him. And we wouldn't come back. Never. I cried out loud. And since I am able to prevent any such idea crossing the mind of the dictator who governs my life, I will do so. By turning this document in every direction he might accidentally discover the code, I'm going to destroy it. The fire hadn't quite gone out. I picked up the parchment. My trembling hand was just about to throw the whole lot onto the coals and thus destroy the dangerous secret when the study door opened. My uncle came in. I had barely had time to put the wretched document back on the desk. Professor Lidenbrock seemed preoccupied. His obsessive idea clearly hadn't given him a moment's rest. He had obviously pondered the question during his walk, considered it, called on every resource of his imagination, and he had plainly come back to try out some new combination. Sure enough, he sat down in his armchair and, pen in hand, began to write out formulae that looked like algebraic calculations. For 3 long hours, my uncle worked without a word, without looking up, rubbing out, starting again, crossing out, setting to for the umpteenth time. I knew full well that if he managed to put the letters into every single order possible, then the right sentence would come out. But I also knew that a mere 20 letters can form 2,432,902,008,176,640,000 combinations. In fact, there were 132 letters in the sentence, and these 132 letters produced a total number of sentences that had at least 133 digits. One that is virtually impossible to enumerate, and goes completely beyond the bounds of imagination. I therefore felt reassured about the heroic way of solving the problem. But time passed. Night came. The street noises died down. My uncle, still bent over his work, didn't see anything, didn't notice Martha half opening the door. He heard nothing, not even the voice of the faithful servant. "Will sir be dining tonight?" Martha had to go away again without a response. As for myself, after fighting it for some time, an irresistible drowsiness came over me, and I fell asleep on the end of the sofa, while my uncle Lidenbrock continued his adding up, his taking away, and his crossing out. When I woke again the following morning, the inexorable worker was still at it. His eyes were red, his face pale, his hair tousled by a feverish hand, and his cheekbones glowed purple. All were signs of a terrible struggle with the impossible, showing what tiredness of mind and what exertions of the brain must have filled the long hours. I was genuinely sorry for him. In spite of the reproaches I probably had the right to make, I felt considerable pity. With a single act, I could undo the iron hoop wrapped tight around his brain, with just one word. I did nothing. But I had a kind heart. Why did I not speak out in such circumstances, for my uncle's own sake? "No, no," I repeated, "no. I'm not going to say anything. He would only want to go there. I know him. Nothing would stop him. He has a volcanic imagination, and he would risk his life to do what no geologist has ever done before. I will not say anything. I will keep this secret given to me by chance, and to let it out would be tantamount to killing Professor Lidenbrock. Let him guess if he can. I don't want to feel responsible one day for having sent him to his death." Once my mind was made up, I crossed my arms and waited. But I hadn't reckoned with something that happened a few hours later. When Martha tried to go out to the market, she found the door locked. The big key was not in the keyhole. Who had taken it out? Obviously my uncle, when he had come back from his hasty excursion the day before. Was it on purpose or through absent-mindedness? Did he want us to feel real hunger pains? That seemed to be going a bit far. Why should Martha and I suffer because of a situation that had nothing whatsoever to do with us? But apparently this was the case. And I recalled a frightening precedent. A few years before, when my uncle had been working on his grand mineral classification, he had remained 48 hours without eating, and his whole household had had to follow his scientific diet. As a result, I acquired stomach cramps that were not much fun for a boy of a fairly ravenous nature. I resolved to be heroic, and not to give in to the demands of hunger. At about 12 o'clock, though, hunger began to cause me serious problems. Martha very innocently had devoured the supplies in the larder the day before, and so there was nothing left in the whole house. I held on, however. I considered it a matter of honour. 2 o'clock chimed. The situation was becoming ridiculous, intolerable even. My eyes began to look very big. I started to tell myself that I was exaggerating the importance of the document, that in any case my uncle wouldn't believe what it said, that he would regard it as a mere practical joke, that if the worst came to the worst, he could be restrained against his will if he wanted to attempt the expedition, and that he might easily find the code himself, in which case all my efforts of abstinence would have been in vain. These all seemed excellent reasons to me, although I would have indignantly rejected them the day before. I even considered it a terrible mistake to have waited so long, and I made up my mind to reveal all. I was therefore looking for a way into the subject, one that wasn't too sudden, when without warning the professor stood up, put his hat on, and got ready to go out. "Uncle!" He didn't appear to have heard. "Uncle Liddenbrock!" I repeated, raising my voice. He said, like someone abruptly woken. "What about the key?"
"What key? The door?"
"No," I cried, "the key to the document." The professor scrutinized me over his glasses. He must have noticed something unusual in my face, for he firmly grabbed me by the arm while still carefully inspecting me, although unable to utter a word. All the same, never was a question asked more clearly. I moved my head up and down. He shook his, with a sort of pity, as if dealing with a lunatic. I made a more positive sign. His eyes shone brighter. His hand became threatening. Given the situation, this silent conversation would have absorbed the most indifferent spectator. I had, in fact, really reached the point of not daring to say anything. Such was my fear of my uncle suffocating me when he first began to joyfully embrace me. But he became so insistent that I just had to speak. "Yes, the code, purely by chance." I hadn't finished before the professor produced a shout, more than a shout, an actual roar. A revelation had just occurred in his brain. His face was transmogrified.
"Oh, clever old Saknussemm," he bellowed. "So you wrote your message backwards."
And throwing himself on the sheet of paper, his eyes unfocused, his voice trembling, he spelled out the whole document, working his way from the last letter back to the first. This is what he read.
"In Schneffels Joculis Craterem Chem Delibat Umbra Scataris Julii Intra Calendas Descende Audas Viato et Terrestre Centrum Attinges Cod Feci Arne Saknussemm."
Which translates as, "Go down into the crater of Schneffels Jokul, which the shadow of Scataris caresses before the kalends of July, O audacious traveller, and you will reach the centre of the earth. I did it, Arne Saknussemm." As he read, my uncle jumped up as if drawing current from a Leyden jar. His courage, his joy, his certainty knew no bounds. He walked up and down, he held his head in both hands, he moved the chairs around, he piled the books up. Unbelievably, he juggled with his precious geodes. He threw a punch here and a blow there. At last his nerves calmed down, and like a man exhausted, he flopped back in his armchair.
"So, what time is it?"
he asked after a few moments' silence. 3 o'clock, I replied.
"Lunch has gone down quickly. I'm dying of hunger. To table. And then, after that, you can pack our trunks."
Thank you.
The professor's words had sent a shiver through my whole body. I kept my self-control, though. I even resolved to put on a brave face. Only scientific arguments could stop Professor Lidenbrock now, and there were no lack of arguments, and good ones, against such a journey being possible. Go to the centre of the Earth? What madness! I had to try to persuade him against such a crazy scheme, and said, couldn't the old parchment just be a practical joke? A sort of smile played over my stern questioner's lips, and he replied,
that is what we are going to find out.
I said, a little annoyed. Allow me first to exhaust all possible objections concerning the document.
Speak, my boy. Give yourself full rein. I grant you every freedom to express your opinion. You are no longer my nephew, but my colleague. Pray proceed.
Well, I will first ask you what Yokel, Snaffles, and Skataris mean, since I have never even heard of them.
That's easy. As it happens, I received a map not very long ago from my friend, August Petermann of Leipzig. It couldn't have arrived at a better time. Take down the third atlas on the second shelf in the big bookcase, Series Z, Shelf 4.
I got up and, thanks to the precise instructions, quickly found the required atlas. My uncle opened it.
See this island of volcanoes, said the professor. And notice that they all bear the name Jökull. This means glacier in Icelandic. And at the northern latitude, most of the eruptions reach the light of day through layers of ice. Hence this name, Jökull, applied to all fire-producing peaks of the island.
Fine, but what about Schneefels? I hoped there would be no answer to this question. I was wrong.
Follow me along the western coast of Iceland. Do you see Reykjavik, the capital? Yes. Good. Work your way up along the countless fields of these shorelines, eaten by the sea, and stop a little before the line of 65 degrees north. What do you see?
A peninsula, rather like a bare bone, with an enormous kneecap at the end, I said.
Not an inappropriate comparison, my dear boy. Now, do you see anything on the kneecap?
Yes, a mountain that looks as if it sprouted in the middle of the sea.
Good. That is Schneefels, said the professor.
Schneefels?
The one and only. A 5,000-foot-high mountain, one of the most remarkable on the island, and definitely the most famous in the whole world if its crater leads to the centre of the globe.
But it's quite impossible, I said, raising my shoulders in protest at such a conjecture.
Impossible? Said Professor Lidenbrock severely. And why should that be?
Because this crater is obviously blocked up with lava and scorching rocks, and so...
And supposing it is an extinct crater?
Extinct?
Yes. There are now only about 300 volcanoes in activity on the surface of the Earth, but the number of extinct ones is much greater. Schneefels falls into this latter category, and in historical times has only had a single eruption, the 1219 one. Since then, its rumblings have gradually died down, and it is no longer considered an active volcano.
But what does the word Skataris mean? And what have the calends of July got to do with anything? I asked. My uncle had an answer to that question, too.
Our Icelandic scholar observed that as the calends of July approached, that is, towards the end of June, one of the mountain peaks, called Skataris, cast its shadow as far as the opening of the relevant crater, and he noted this fact in his document. Could he have found a more precise indication, and, once we are on the summit of Schneefels, can there be a moment's hesitation as to the path to follow?
But I couldn't give up so easily and said, all right, I'm forced to accept that Saknussemm's message is clear and that can leave no doubt in one's mind. I even grant that the document looks perfectly authentic. So, this scholar went to the bottom of Schneefels, saw the shadow of Skataris lingering on the edge of the crater just before the calends of July. He probably even heard the people of this time recounting legends that this crater led to the centre of the Earth. But as to whether he went down there himself, whether he carried out the journey and came back, whether he even undertook it. No. 100 times, no.
And the reason? Asked my uncle in a singularly mocking tone.
Because all the scientific theories demonstrate that such an undertaking is impossible.
All the theories say that?
replied the professor, putting on a good-natured appearance. "Oh, the nasty theories! They are going to get terribly in our way, the poor theories!" I could see that he was making fun of me, but continued regardless. "Yes, it is well known that the temperature increases by approximately 1 degree centigrade for every 70 feet you go below the surface of the globe. Now, assuming that this ratio remains constant, and given that the radius of the Earth is about 4,000 miles, the temperature at the centre will be well over 200,000 degrees centigrade. The substances at the Earth's core exist, therefore, as white-hot gases, for even metals like gold or platinum, even the hardest rocks, cannot resist such a temperature. My question whether it is possible to travel in such an environment is consequently a reasonable one."
"So, Axel, it is the heat that bothers you."
"Certainly. If we were to attain a depth of only 25 miles, we would have reached the limit of the Earth's crust, for the temperature would already be more than 1,400 degrees centigrade.
And are you afraid of melting?"
"I leave the question for you to decide," I replied sharply.
"Here is what I decide," said Professor Lidenbrock, assuming an important air. "It is that neither you nor anyone else knows for certain what happens in the Earth's interior, given that scarcely a 1/12,000th part of its radius is known. It is that science is eminently perfectible, and that each existing theory is constantly replaced by a new one. Was it not believed before Fourier that the temperature of interplanetary space went down indefinitely? And is it not known now that the greatest cold in the ether does not go below 40 or 50 degrees below zero? Why should it not be the same for the internal heat? Why, at a certain depth, should it not encounter a limit that cannot be crossed, instead of reaching the point where the most obdurate minerals liquefy? You see, Axel, the state of the central core has produced various hypotheses among geologists. Nothing is less proven than the idea of internal heat. In my view, it does not exist, could not possibly exist. In any case, we shall see for ourselves, and like Arne Saknussemm, discover where we stand on this important question."
"Yes, we shall see," I shouted, won over by his excitement.
"We'll see for ourselves, provided, that is, anything at all can be seen down there. And why not? Can we not count on electrical phenomena to light the way, and even on the atmosphere, which the pressure may make more and more luminous as the centre approaches?"
"Yes, yes, it's possible after all," I said.
"It is certain," retorted my uncle in triumph. "But it must be kept quiet, do you hear? All this must be maintained totally secret, so that no one else has the idea of discovering the centre of the Earth before us."
Our journey began the very next day. We crossed the border into Holstein province, where we boarded a train bound for Kiel, then by steamship to Copenhagen, sailing on the Eleonora. I had hoped that no means of transport would be available, but this was not to be. A little Danish schooner, the Valkyrie, was due to sail for Reykjavik on the 2nd of June. The captain, a Mr. Bjarni, was on board. His future passenger, overjoyed, shook his hand hard enough to break it. This simple man was surprised by such a grip. He found it quite normal to go to Iceland. That was his job. But my uncle found it sublime. The worthy captain took advantage of my uncle's enthusiasm to make us pay double for the voyage. But we weren't bothered by such trifles. At 6 a.m. on the 2nd, our precious luggage was already stowed on board the Valkyrie. The captain led us down to the cabins that were rather narrow and situated under a sort of deckhouse.
"Is the wind with us?"
inquired my uncle.
"Perfectly," replied Captain Bjarni. "From the southeast. We can leave the sound with a wind on the quarter and all sails set."
"How long will the voyage take?"
asked my uncle. "About 10 days if we don't have too many nor'esters windward of the Faroes."
"But you don't normally encounter significant delays?"
"No, Professor Lidenbrock. Don't worry, we'll get there."
The captain was as good as his word. The crossing passed uneventfully, and although the professor endured some seasickness, before long we sighted to the east the beacon of Point Skagen, whose dangerous rocks extend a long way out under the waves. An Icelandic pilot came on board, and 3 hours later the Valkyrie dropped anchor in Faxa Bay, beside Reykjavik itself. The professor finally came out of his cabin, a little pale and a little shaky, but still enthusiastic and with a gleam of satisfaction in his eye. The population of the town, enthralled by the arrival of a ship in which each expected something, congregated on the quayside. My uncle was in a hurry to flee this floating prison, but before leaving the deck of the schooner, he dragged me forward. There, near the northern part of the bay, stood a high mountain, with 2 points on top, a double cone covered with perpetual snows.
"Schneffels!" he roared. "Schneffels!"
He made a sign indicating total secrecy, and then climbed down into the waiting boat. Soon we were standing on the soil of Iceland itself. A charming citizen, whose help became extremely precious, was Mr. Fridriksson, who taught science at Reykjavik School. This humble scholar spoke only Icelandic and Latin. He came and offered his services in the language of Horace, and I felt that we were bound to understand each other. He was, in fact, the only person I could converse with my entire stay in Iceland. Of the 3 rooms making up his household, this excellent man put 2 at our disposal, and soon we were ensconced there together with our luggage, whose quantity slightly surprised the inhabitants of Reykjavik.
"Well, Axel," said my uncle, "things are working out. We are over the worst."
"What do you mean, the worst?"
"I mean it's downhill all the way."
"In that sense, you are right. But having gone down, won't we eventually have to come back up?"
"Oh, that will present no problem. Look, there is no time to be lost. I am going to visit the library. It might contain some manuscript of Saknussemm's, and if so, I would very much like to have a look at it."
"Well, then, during that time, I'll visit the town. Aren't you going to have a look at it yourself?"
"To tell the truth, I am not very much drawn by all that. What is interesting in this country of Iceland is below the ground, not above."
I went out and walked around at random. To get lost in the 2 streets of Reykjavik would have been difficult. After a good walk, I returned to Mr. Fridriksson's house. My uncle was already there, together with his host. Dinner was ready. It was devoured with great gusto by Professor Lidenbrock, whose stomach had become a deep chasm during the forced abstinence on board. The meal, more Danish than Icelandic, involved nothing remarkable in itself. But our host, more Icelandic than Danish, reminded me of the heroes of classical hospitality. Conversation used the native tongue, interspersed for my sake with German by my uncle and Latin by Mr. Fridriksson. It concerned scientific subjects, as is appropriate for scholars, but Professor Lidenbrock maintained a very strict reserve, and at each sentence his eyes told me to keep a total silence about our future plans. First, Mr. Fridriksson questioned my uncle about the results of his research in the library. I looked at my uncle. He could not decide whether or not to reply. This matter concerned his projects directly. However, after thinking for a while, he decided to speak.
Mr. Fridriksson, I wish to know whether you have amongst the oldest works those of a certain Arne Saknussemm.
Arne Saknussemm? You are referring to that scholar of the 18th century who was a great naturalist, a great alchemist, and a great traveller?
Precisely.
One of the stars of Icelandic literature and science.
As you so well put it.
One of the most illustrious of men.
Most certainly.
And whose courage was as great as his genius?
I see you know him perfectly.
My uncle was in ecstasy to hear his hero spoken of in this way. He was devouring Mr. Fridriksson with his eyes.
Well, he asked, what about his works?
His works? We do not have.
What? Even in Iceland?
They do not exist in Iceland or anywhere else.
And why ever not?
Because Arne Saknussemm was persecuted for heresy, and his works were burned in Copenhagen in 1573 by the hand of the executioner.
Good! Splendid!
Shouted my uncle, greatly shocking the science teacher.
Eh?
Yes! Everything is explained. Everything fits together. All is clear. And now I understand why Saknussemm, having been forced to hide the discoveries of his genius, had to conceal the secret in an incomprehensible word puzzle.
What secret?
Inquired Mr. Fridrikson keenly. A secret that by means of... spluttered my uncle.
Do you by any chance have some special document?
No, I was making a pure supposition, said my uncle.
Fine,
replied Mr. Fridrikson, who had observed my uncle's confusion and was kind enough not to insist. My uncle told Mr. Fridrikson of our wish to explore the extinct volcano, Sneffels, and our kindly host promised to provide us with a guide on the morrow. In the evening, I went for a brief walk along the seafront of Reykjavik, came back early and then retired to my bed of rough planks, where I slept the sleep of the just. On waking up, I heard my uncle talking volubly in the next room. I quickly got up and joined him. He was speaking Danish with a tall man, robustly built. This great strapping figure was clearly of unusual strength. His eyes, in a head of very considerable size and a certain naivety, appeared intelligent to me. They were of a dreamy blue colour. Long hair, which would have passed for red even in Britain, fell on athletic shoulders. This native was supple in his movements, but moved his arms little, like a man who didn't know the language of gestures or didn't bother to use it. Everything about him revealed a perfectly calm nature, not lazy, but composed. You felt that he didn't require anything from anyone, that he worked as it suited him, that his philosophy of life couldn't be astonished or disturbed by anything in this world. I was able to detect the nuances of the Icelander's character by the way he listened to the passionate flow of words addressed to him. He remained with his arms crossed, not moving despite my uncle's repeated gesticulations. To say no, his head turned from left to right, to say yes, downwards, but so little that his long hair hardly moved. He was not so much economical with his movements as tight-fisted. This serious, phlegmatic, silent type was called Hans Bjelke, and he came with Mr. Fridrikson's recommendations. He was our future guide, whose manner contrasted singularly with my uncle's. Nevertheless, they got on well from the start. Neither of them discussed prices, the one ready to accept whatever was offered, the other to pay whatever was asked. Never was a deal easier to reach. Once the agreement had been reached, the hunter promptly left.
"He's perfect," exclaimed my uncle, "but he can hardly realize the brilliant part he is going to play."
"So he's coming with us?"
"To the center of the earth."
There were still 48 hours left, but to my great regret, I had to use them for the preparations. All our intelligence was employed organizing the things in the most useful way. The instruments here, the firearms there, the tools in this package, the food in that. Four groups in all. The instruments included a centigrade thermometer made by Eigel, graduated to 150 degrees, which didn't seem quite right to me. Too much if the temperature went up as far as that, since we would be cooked, but not enough to measure the temperature of hot springs or other molten substances. A manometer, operated by compressed air, designed to show pressures greater than that at sea level. An ordinary barometer would not have been sufficient, given that the atmospheric pressure was due to increase proportionally with our descent underground. A chronometer by Boissonas Jr. of Geneva, perfectly set to the Hamburg meridian. Two compasses to measure positive and negative inclination. A night glass. Two Ruhmkorff lamps, which used an electric current to give a highly portable source of light, reliable and not too bulky. The arms consisted of two rifles from Purdley Moore & Co. and two Colt revolvers. Why take them? I didn't imagine we were going to encounter all that many savages or wild beasts. But my uncle seemed very attached to his arsenal and his instruments, and especially to a considerable quantity of gun cotton, which is unaffected by damp and whose explosive power is far greater than that of ordinary powder. The tools were two ice picks, two pickaxes, one ladder made of silk, three alpenstocks, one axe, one hammer, a dozen iron wedges and pitons, and several long knotted ropes. This could not help making a large packet, for the ladder alone was 300 feet in length. Finally, there were the provisions. The parcel was not a big one, but was reassuring, for I knew that it contained 6 months' supply of dried meat and biscuits. Gin was the only liquid, with water totally absent.
We had flasks, and my uncle counted on springs to fill them. The objections I raised as to their quality, temperature, and even existence were ignored. To complete the list of our travel items, I will mention a portable medical kit containing blunt-bladed scissors, splints for fractures, a strip of Holland material, bandages and compresses, sticking plaster, a basin for bloodletting, terrifying objects in themselves, but in addition a whole series of bottles containing dextrin, surgical spirit, liquid acetate of lead, ether, vinegar and ammonia, all drugs of a frightening nature, and finally the materials necessary for the Ruhmkorff lamps. My uncle was careful not to forget a supply of tobacco, powder for hunting, and tinder, nor a leather belt he wore round his waist, and which contained an adequate supply of money in gold, silver, and paper form. 6 stout pairs of shoes, waterproofed by means of a coating of tar and gutta percha, fell into the category of miscellaneous items. The following day, our preparations were finished. Our host delighted the professor by presenting him with a chart of Iceland, which was incomparably better than Henderson's. It was the map drawn up by Mr. Olaf Nicholas Olsen, on a scale of 1 to 480,000, published by the Icelandic Literary Society, and based on Mr. Sheil Friesack's geodesic work, and Mr. Bjorn Gumlagson's topographical survey. It constituted a precious document for a mineralogist. We left in overcast but settled weather. No exhausting heat to fear, no disastrous rain. Weather for tourists. The joy of riding through an unknown land made me easy to please at the beginning of our adventure. I was caught up in the happiness of those who go on journeys, a feeling of hope mixed with a sense of freedom. I began to feel involved in the trip. Hans walked in front, at a quick but regular and unchanging pace. The 2 horses followed with our luggage, without his having to lead them. My uncle and I came last, trying not to make too much of a sight of ourselves on our small but hardy mounts.
"Nice animal, nice animal," my uncle kept saying. "You will see, Axel, that a creature more intelligent than the Icelandic horse does not exist. Snows, storms, blocked paths, rocks, glaciers, nothing stops him. He is brave, he is cautious, he is reliable. Never a foot wrong, never a false reaction. Should a stream appear, a fjord to be crossed, and they will appear, you will see him throw himself unhesitatingly into the water like an amphibian and swim across to the other side. If we do not upset him, if we let him do as he wishes, we shall cover our 25 miles a day, the one carrying the other."
"We will, I'm sure, but what about the guide?"
"Oh, I am not worried about him. That sort of person walks without noticing. Our guide moves so little that he cannot possibly get tired. In any case, I will give him my horse if need be. I would soon get cramps if I did not take some exercise. My arms feel all right, but one must not neglect one's legs."
For several days we travelled thus, until eventually we arrived at a place called Stapi. Stapi is a settlement of about 30 shacks, built on the lava itself and under the rays of the sun reflected from the volcano. It lies at the end of a little fjord which forms part of a basalt wall of a most curious appearance. Here, Hans hired the services of 3 Icelanders to replace the horses carrying the luggage. Once we got to the bottom of the crater, these locals would have to turn back, leaving us on our own. That point was made clear. At this juncture, my uncle had to tell our guide of his intention to continue his exploration of the volcano to its furthermost limits. Hans merely inclined his head. Whether he went there or somewhere else, whether he plunged into the innards of his island or travelled over its surface, made no difference to him. I myself had rather forgotten about the future, distracted until this point by the events of the journey, but now felt my feelings taking hold of me more than ever. What could I do? If I had wanted to try and stand up to Professor Lidenbrock, it ought to have been in Hamburg, and not at the foot of Schneefels. My uncle had defeated me by means of scientific arguments. I had one remaining hope, however, that once we had got to the bottom of the crater, it would be impossible, for lack of gallery, to go any deeper, in spite of all the Saknussems in the world. I spent the night in the clutches of a nightmare. I was in the middle of a volcano in the depths of the earth. I felt as if I was being thrown into interplanetary space in the form of eruptive rock. The following day, the 23rd of June, Hans was waiting for us with his companions, who were loaded down with food, tools and instruments. Two of the iron-tipped sticks, two rifles and two cartridge belts were set aside for my uncle and myself. Hans, a man of foresight, had added to our bags a full goatskin water bottle, which, together with our flasks, meant we had water for a week. Schneefels is 5,000 feet high. Its double cone marks the end of a trachytic strip which branches off the main relief system of the island. From our point of departure, we couldn't see its two peaks in profile against the greyish background of the sky. I could only see an enormous snowy cap lowered on the giant's forehead. We were walking in single file, following the hunter. He was climbing up narrow paths where two men couldn't have proceeded abreast. All conversation, therefore, became more or less impossible. 3 hours' tiring march had only brought us as far as the base of the mountain. At this point, Hans called a halt, and we all shared a quick lunch. My uncle took double mouthfuls to save time, but since this halt was also a rest period, he was forced to wait until the guide was completely ready. He gave the signal for departure an hour later. The three Icelanders, as taciturn as their hunter companion, didn't say a single word and ate soberly. We now began to move up the slopes of Schneefels. By an optical illusion common with mountains, its snow-covered summit seemed to me very close, and yet how many long hours it took to reach it! Above all, what fatigue! The stones, not held together by earth or grass, rolled away from under our feet and disappeared towards the plain with the speed of an avalanche. To judge from the height of the peak of Schneefels, I assumed it was impossible for us to reach it from this side, unless the angle of the slope decreased. Fortunately, after an hour of tiring efforts and considerable feats, a sort of staircase suddenly appeared in the middle of a vast carpet of snow built up on top of the volcano. And this helped our climb. It was formed by one of those rivers of stones thrown out by the eruptions. By 7 in the evening, we had climbed the 2,000 steps of the staircase. We stood at the top of a big swelling of the mountain, a sort of base on which rested the cone forming the crater. The sea stretched out at a depth of 3,200 feet. We were above the line of the perpetual snows, at a relatively low level in Iceland because of the constant humidity of the climate. It was bitterly cold. The wind blew hard. I felt utterly exhausted. The professor saw clearly that my legs were refusing to carry me and decided to stop, despite his impatience. He therefore made a sign to the hunter, who shook his head, saying,
"Ofanfur."
"Apparently we need to go higher." He asked Hans the reason for this reply.
"Mistur."
"Ja, mistur," repeated one of the Icelanders in a frightened tone. "What does the word mean?" I asked anxiously.
"Look there," replied my uncle.
I turned to look at the plain. An immense column of ground-up pumice stone, sand and dust was climbing, swirling like a waterspout. The wind was driving it against the flank of Schneefels, which we were now clinging onto. This opaque curtain spread out in front of the sun and threw a large shadow over the whole mountain.
"Hastig! Hastig!"
shouted the guide. Without knowing Danish, I understood we had to follow Hans as quickly as possible. he began to work his way round the cone of the crater at an angle for easier going. Soon the waterspout crashed down on the mountain, which quivered at the shock. The stones caught up in the eddies rained down as if in an eruption. Fortunately, we were on the other side and sheltered from all danger. If it hadn't been for the guide's precaution, our torn bodies would have been pulverized and dropped far away like the product of some unknown meteor. However, Hans didn't consider it prudent to spend the night on the side of the cone. We continued our zigzagging ascent. The 1,500 feet still to be covered took nearly 5 hours, for the detours, diagonal paths, and retreats measured at least 8 miles. I couldn't go on. I was overcome by cold and hunger. The air was slightly rarefied and insufficient to fill my lungs. Finally, at 11 at night, very much in darkness, we reached the summit of Schneefels. Before going to shelter inside the crater, I caught sight of the midnight sun at the lowest point in its life's course, sending its pale rays over the island asleep at my feet. Next day, my uncle was anxious to continue our journey.
"To the crater," he said, rising early.
The crater of Schneefels formed an inverted cone, whose mouth was probably slightly more than a mile across. It seemed to me to be about 2,000 feet deep. One should imagine the state of such a receptacle when it was filling up with thunder and flames. The bottom of the funnel was only about 500 feet in circumference, so its relatively gentle slopes allowed one to reach the lower part with ease. I couldn't help comparing this crater to an enormous widened-out blunderbuss, and the comparison terrified me. To climb down into a blunderbuss, I thought, when it may be loaded and could go off at the least shock, you've got to be crazy. But there was no going back. With an indifferent expression, Hans took the lead. I followed him without a word. At the bottom of the crater opened 3 vents, through which, at the time when Schneefels used to erupt, the central fire forced its lava and its steam. Each of these chimneys was about 100 feet across. There they were, wide open, beneath our feet. I didn't dare look down into them. As for Professor Lidenbrock, he had quickly examined their shape and size. He was breathing heavily, running from one to the other, waving his arms and shouting unintelligible words. Hans and his companions sat on hummocks of lava and watched. They clearly took him for a madman. Suddenly, my uncle cried out. At first, I thought he had lost his footing and fallen into one of the 3 holes. But then I saw him, standing, arms outstretched and legs apart in front of a granite boulder placed at the centre of the crater, like an enormous pedestal designed for a statue of Pluto. He stood like a man dumbstruck. But it soon turned instead into an insane happiness.
"Axel! Axel, come here! Down here!"
I ran down. Hans and the Icelanders stayed exactly where they were.
"Look,"
said the professor. Dumbstruck like him, but markedly less happy, I read on the western side of the boulder, in runic characters gnawed by time, the 1,000 times accursed name.
"Arne Saknussem!" shouted my uncle. "Can you have any doubt now?"
I didn't reply, but came back to my lava seat in a state of total confusion. I was crushed by the evidence. The following day, a grey sky, cloudy and heavy, lowered over the summit of the cone. I noticed this less from the darkness of the chasm than from the anger that took hold of my uncle. I understood why, and at last a feeling of hope came back to me. The reason was as follows. Of the 3 routes open under our feet, only one had been followed by Saknussemm. According to the Icelandic scholar, it was to be identified by the particularity described in the cryptogram, namely that the shadow of Skataris came and played along its edge during the last few days of the month of June. This sharp peak could thus be described as a huge sundial, whose silhouette on a given day marked the way to the centre of our globe. If by chance the sun was not there, no shadow, consequently no sign. It was the 25th of June. Should the sky stay overcast for 6 more days, the expedition would have to be put off to another year. I will not attempt to describe Professor Lidenbrock's impotent rage. The day passed without a shadow coming down to the bottom of the crater. Hans didn't move from where he was, although he must have wondered what we were waiting for, if he wondered anything. My uncle didn't address a single word to me. His eyes invariably turned to the sky, blended into the grey and misty background. On the 26th, still nothing. Rain mixed with snow fell during the day. Hans built a hut with pieces of lava. I took some pleasure from watching the thousands of improvised cascades running down the sides of the cone, with each stone adding to the deafening murmur. My uncle could no longer hold himself back. The most patient man could legitimately be irritated, for this really was sinking while coming into harbour. The sky was still covered the following day. But on Sunday the 28th of June, the third last day of the month, the change of the moon coincided with a change in the weather. The sun poured its abundant rays down into the crater. Each hummock, each rock, each boulder, each bump had its share of the luminous flow and instantly cast its shadow on the ground. That of Scutaris, especially, stood out like a sharp stone and began to turn imperceptibly with the radiant orb. My uncle turned with it. At the middle of the day, when it was shortest, it came and gently kissed the edge of the middle chimney.
"It is there! There it is!" shouted the professor. "To the centre of the globe,"
he added in Danish. I looked at Hans.
"Forward,"
he said calmly.
"Forward,"
replied my uncle. It was 1:13. The real journey began. Until now, things had been more tiring than difficult, but henceforth problems were literally going to spring forth under our feet. The middle chimney was 100 feet across, or about 300 feet right round. I leant over an overhanging rock and looked. My hair stood on end. An impression of void took hold of my being. I felt the centre of gravity moving through me and dizziness going to my head like a heady brew. The descent began in the following order. Hans, my uncle, myself. It proceeded in deep silence, broken only by rock debris falling into the abyss. I allowed myself to flow, so to speak, with one hand desperately holding on to the double rope and the other using my alpenstock to slow me down. A single idea obsessed me. I was afraid of losing all means of support. This rope seemed to me very fragile for bearing the weight of 3 people. I used it as little as possible, performing miracles of balance on the lava projections that my foot tried to hold onto like a hand. When one of these precarious steps happened to dislodge under Hans's feet, he would say in his calm voice,
"Give acht."
"Careful,"
repeated my uncle. After 30 minutes, we had reached the top of a boulder, solidly attached to the wall of the chimney. Hans pulled one of the ends of the rope, and the other rose in the air. Having gone round the rock at the top, it fell back, dragging down pieces of rock and lava, a sort of rain or rather hail full of danger. Leaning over our narrow platform, I noticed that the bottom of the hole could still not be seen. The rope manoeuvre began again, and 30 minutes later we had got 200 feet deeper. After some time of this slow descent, I calculated that we had used the rope 14 times, taking 30 minutes each time. So we'd spent 7 hours plus 14 rest periods of 15 minutes, or 3.5 hours, 10.5 in total. Since we had left at 1, it had to be about 11 now. As for the depth reached, the 14 operations of the rope gave 2,800 feet. At that moment, Hans's voice was heard.
"Halt."
I stopped dead at the moment my feet were about to collide with my uncle's head.
"We are there,"
he said. Where?
I asked, slipping down beside him.
At the bottom of the perpendicular chimney.
And is there a way out?
Yes. I can just see a sort of corridor at an angle towards the right. We will have a look at it tomorrow. Let's eat, and then we can sleep.
It was still not completely dark. We opened the food bag, ate, and lay down, each doing his best to make a bed out of the stone and lava debris. Lying on my back, I opened my eyes and caught sight of a brilliant object at the other end of the 3,000-foot-long tube, converted into a giant telescope. It was a star, but not twinkling at all. According to my calculations, it was Beta of the Little Bear. Then I fell into a deep sleep. At 8 in the morning, a ray of daylight came and woke us up. The 1,000 facets of the lava on the walls picked it up on the way down and scattered it everywhere like a rain of sparks. These gleams were enough for us to be able to distinguish the surrounding objects. My uncle pulled from his pocket a notebook designed for observations. He examined each of the various instruments in turn and wrote down the date.
Monday, the 1st of July. Chronometer 8:17 anti-meridian, barometer 29 7/12, thermometer 6 degrees centigrade, direction east, south east.
The last observation referred to the dark corridor as indicated by the compass.
Now, Axel, cried the professor enthusiastically, we are going to penetrate the globe's bowels proper. This is the precise moment when our journey begins.
Saying that, with one hand he took the Ruhmkorff lamp, which was hanging round his neck. With the other, he applied the electric current to the filament of the lamp, and a brightish light chased the darkness away. During its last eruption, the lava had forced its way through the tunnel. It had carpeted the inside with a thick, shiny coating. The electric light was now reflected in it, becoming 100 times brighter. The lava, porous in places, was covered with little round bulbs. Crystals of opaque quartz, decorated with clear drops of glass, hung from the vaulted ceiling like chandeliers, and seemed to light up as we passed. It was as if the spirits of the underground were lighting up their palace to welcome their guests from the earth.
"It's magnificent!" I shouted in spite of myself. "What a sight, Uncle! Look at the colours in the lava, which go from reddish-brown to bright yellow, absolutely continuously! And these crystals that look like luminous globes!"
Ah, you are getting there, Axel. So, you admire all that, my boy. You will see lots more, I hope. Come on, off we go.
At about 8 in the evening, he gave the signal to stop. Hans immediately sat down. The lamps were hung from convenient pieces of lava. We were in a sort of cavern, where there was no lack of air. On the contrary, we felt a wind blowing. What was causing it? What movement in the atmosphere did it come from? I wasn't really interested in answering the question at that moment. Hunger and tiredness made me unable to think. A descent of 7 hours without stopping produces a great depletion of energy. I was exhausted and had been very glad to hear the word halt. Hans spread out a few things to eat on a block of lava, and each of us dined hungrily. One thing worried me, though. Half our supply of water had been used up. My uncle planned to replenish it at underwater springs, but there hadn't been a single one so far. I couldn't help mentioning it to him.
Are you surprised by the absence of streams?
Yes, and even worried. We have water left for only 5 days.
Oh, don't worry, Axel. My reply is that we will find water, and more than we want.
When?
When we have left the lava envelope. How do you think that springs can get through these walls?
But the lava flow may continue to a great depth, and we don't seem to have gone very far yet in a vertical direction.
What makes you say that?
Because if we had gone a long way into the interior of the Earth's crust, the heat would be greater than it is.
According to your system, what does the thermometer say?
Hardly 15 degrees, which is only 9 degrees more than when we left.
And your conclusion?
Well, I conclude as follows. From the most precise observations, we know that the temperature increases by 1 degree for every 100 feet you go into the interior of the globe. But local conditions can sometimes alter that figure. Thus, in Yakutsk in Siberia, it has been observed that the increase is 1 degree for every 36 feet. The difference clearly depends on the conductivity of the rock. One can also add that in the neighbourhood of an extinct volcano, through the gneiss, the increase is only 1 degree for every 125 feet. Let us therefore take this last hypothesis, which is the most favourable, and let us calculate.
Calculate on, my boy.
It's child's play, I said, jotting the figures down in my notebook. 9 times 125 feet gives 1,125 feet deep.
So it does?
Well?
Well, according to my observations, we are now 10,000 feet below sea level.
Are we really?
Yes, or else figures are no longer figures.
The professor's calculations were correct. We had gone 6,000 feet further than the greatest depths achieved by man, such as the mines of Kitzbühel in the Tyrol or those of Württemberg in Bohemia. The temperature, which should have been 81 degrees at this spot, was barely 15. At 6 a.m. the following day, Tuesday the 30th of June, the journey began again. We were still following the lava gallery, truly a natural ramp, as gentle as those inclined planes that still replace staircases in old houses. This continued until 12:17, the precise moment when we caught up with Hans, who had just stopped.
Ah! Exclaimed my uncle. We have reached the end of the chimney.
I looked around. We were in the middle of an intersection, with two paths heading forward, both of them dark and narrow. Which one were we to take? We had a problem. But my uncle didn't want to appear to be hesitating before either me or the guide. He pointed to the eastern tunnel, and soon all three of us had plunged into it. In any case, any deliberation about the choice of path could have gone on indefinitely, for no sign could possibly determine the choice of one or the other. We had to trust entirely to chance. 6 hours later, after a relatively easy march, we had covered 5 miles in a southerly direction, but scarcely a quarter of a mile in depth. My uncle gave the signal to stop. We ate without talking very much, and then went to sleep without thinking very much. Our arrangements for the night were very simple. Travelling rugs in which we rolled ourselves up were our sole bedding. We had no fear of cold, nor of surprise visits. Those travellers who penetrate to the middle of deserts of Africa or the heart of the forests of the New World are forced to watch over each other during the hours of sleep. But here, absolute solitude and complete safety. Savages or wild beasts, none of these dangers were to be feared. In the morning, we awoke. As I had foreseen, our water had given out completely, and we began to suffer the tortures of thirst. However, Hans led the way as usual. We hadn't gone further than 100 yards when the professor, shining his lamp along the walls, bellowed,
"These are primitive terrains! We are on the right route! Come on! Come on!"
When the earth slowly cooled during the first days of the world, the decrease in volume produced disruptions, breakages, shrinkages, and cracks in the crust. Our present corridor was a fissure of this sort, through which the eruption of the liquid granite had formerly poured out. Its 1,000 paths formed an impossible maze through the primeval ground. As we went further down, the succession of strata making up the primitive terrain appeared more and more clearly. Geological science considers the primitive terrain as the base of the mineral crust and has analysed it into 3 different strata, schists, gneisses, and microschists resting on that immovable rock called granite. Never had mineralogists been in such perfect circumstances for studying nature in situ. The drill, a brutal and unintelligent machine, could not bring its internal texture back to the surface of the globe, but we were going to examine it with our eyes, touch it with our hands. Through the layer of schists, Coloured in wonderful green shades, there meandered metallic seams of copper and manganese, with traces of platinum and gold. I dreamed when I saw these riches, hidden away in the bowels of the earth, which human greed would never enjoy. These treasures were so deeply buried by the upheavals of the first days that neither pick nor drill will ever be able to tear them from their tomb. It was 8 in the evening, and we had still not found any water, and I was in terrible pain. My uncle walked ahead. He wouldn't stop. He kept turning his head in order to detect murmurs from any spring, but none came. Meanwhile, my legs refused to carry me any further. I resisted the agony so that my uncle would not have to call a halt. It would have been a blow of despair for him, as the day was coming to an end, the last one we had. Finally, my strength left me. I uttered a cry and fell down.
Help! I'm dying!
My uncle came back. He examined me, crossing his arms. Then the leaden words came from his lips.
It is finished.
A terrifying gesture of anger struck my eyes one last time, and I closed them. When I opened my eyes again, I saw my two companions motionless, rolled up in their blankets. Were they asleep? For my part, I could not find a moment's repose. Above me was more than 4 miles of Earth's crust. This mass seemed to be leaning with all its weight on my shoulders. I felt crushed, and I wore myself out with violent struggles to turn over on my granite bed. A few hours went by. The deep silence hung around us, the silence of the grave. Nothing reached us through these walls, each of which was at least 5 miles thick. Nevertheless, in the middle of my lethargy, I thought I heard a noise. It was dark in the tunnel. I looked more carefully and thought I could see the Icelander slipping away with the lamp in his hand. Why was he going? Was Hans leaving us to our fate? My uncle was asleep. I tried to cry out. My voice could not find a way through my dried-up lips. It was now very dark and the last sounds had just died away.
Hans is leaving us, I cried. Hans! Hans!
For an hour, my delirious brain ran through all the conceivable reasons that could have made the calm hunter act in this way. The most absurd ideas intersected in my head. I thought I was about to go mad. But finally, the sound of feet could be heard in the depths of the chasm. Hans was coming back up. An indefinite light began to slide along the rock face, then flowed through the mouth of the corridor. Hans reappeared. He went up to my uncle, put a hand on his shoulder, and gently woke him up. My uncle sat up.
What is it? Vatten, replied the guide.
It must be the case that under the inspiration of extreme suffering, everyone becomes multilingual. I did not know a single word of Danish, and yet I instinctively understood our guide's utterance.
Water! Water!
I shouted, clapping my hands and gesticulating like a lunatic.
Water!
Repeated my uncle.
Var?
Nur dat,
replied Hans. Where? Below? I could understand everything. I had seized hold of the guide's hands and was holding them tight while he looked calmly at me. The preparations for departure didn't take long, and we were soon moving down a corridor whose slope was 1 in 3.